From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we remember novelist and screenwriter Larry McMurtry, who died last week at the age of 84. Raised on a Texas ranch, his works depicted the American West.
I grew up with cowboys. I respect them up to a point, but I'm not crazy about them, and I know, I think, something of their limitations.
His novel Lonesome Dove won the Pulitzer Prize and was made into a beloved miniseries. His novels The Last Picture Show and Terms of Endearment were also adapted into films. Also, actor Christopher Maloney, best known for his 12 seasons as Detective Elliot Stabler on Law & Order SVU. He's returning to the franchise, starring in the new series Law & Order Organized Crime. And we'll hear some of Terry's 1980 interview with Watergate conspirator Gordon Liddy, who died Tuesday. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Larry McMurtry, best known for his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Lonesome Dove and other books about the American West, died last week at the age of 84. He wrote more than 30 novels and screenplays, as well as books of essays, memoir, and history. His fiction helped shape the way Americans perceived the Western frontier. McMurtry was raised on a Texas ranch, and his uncles had been cowboys, but he was not one to mythologize the West. He wrote Lonesome Dove about a cattle drive near the end of the 1800s as an anti-Western, and the miniseries adapted from it became a huge hit. McMurtry was also the author of The Last Picture Show and Terms of Endearment, which were both adapted into films, and Horsemen Pass By, which was the basis of the film Hud. McMurtry also became an antiquarian bookseller and collector, inspired in part by his love of reading, which he said helped him envision life beyond the ranch. Before we hear Terry's interview with McMurtry, let's listen to a clip from the TV adaptation of Lonesome Dove. At the heart of the story is the relationship between Augustus McCrae, played by Robert Duvall, and Captain Woodrow Call, played by Tommy Lee Jones. Both are former Texas Rangers. Duvall's character loves life and talks about his feelings. Jones generally doesn't. In this scene, Jones has come upon Duvall, who's weeping over a lost love. The conversation turns to prostitutes, and one Captain Call has apparently fathered a son with.
I don't know why you sit down on whores, Woodrow. You've had yours, as I recall.
Yeah, and that was the worst mistake I ever made.
It ain't a mistake to have been a human being once in your life, Woodrow. Poor little old Maggie left you a fine son before she quit this world.
You don't know that. That boy could be yours or Jake's or some damn gambler.
Yeah, but he ain't. He's yours. Now, anybody with a good eye can see it. Besides, Maggie told me. We were good friends.
I don't know about friends. I'm sure you was a good customer, though.
Well, the two can't overlap, you know.
You're the one that didn't know about overlapping with whores, I reckon.
You know what hurt her most? You wouldn't call her by name. You never would say Maggie. That's what hurt her most.
I don't know what it amounted to if I had.
It would have made her happy.
What are you talking about? She's a whore.
Well, whores got hearts, Woodrow, and Maggie's was the most tender I ever saw.
Well, why didn't you marry her then?
She didn't love me. She loved you. You should have seen how she sat in that saloon every day watching the door after you quit coming around.
I reckon the man has got more to do than to sit in a saloon with a whore.
Like what? Go down the river every night and clean his gun? Maggie needed you. You let her down. You know it, too, don't you?
No, I don't know anything of the dang kind.
And that's why you won't claim that boy as your own, because he's a reminder, see? A living reminder that you failed somebody. And you ain't never going to be up to admitting that. Now, are you?
Like I said, Maggie was just a whore.
Well, I got Woodrow. At least you finally called her by name. I guess that shows some improvement now, don't it?
Terry spoke with Larry McMurtry in 1995.
Of course, I come from ranching stock. I had nine uncles who were cattlemen. My father was a cattleman. Some of my uncles were old enough to participate a little bit in the last years of the trail driving era, which only lasted one generation. The reason there were trail drives is because there were no railroads to transport the cattle to market. As soon as there were railroads, it became very inefficient to drive cattle hundreds and thousands of miles, and of course they stopped. But the myth of the cowboy, as we have it today, came out of that roughly 20-year period, 20, 25 years, after the Civil War, in which the range cattle industry suddenly sort of flowered, like, kind of like the oil industry did a bit later, in which it was necessary to get all the cattle in South Texas, millions of them, north to the markets. And it's very different from ranch life, which is not particularly romantic and not particularly cinematic. So most of the myth of the cowboy came out of that one generation of trail drivers, and it was perfectly possible, since cowboys were often very young, 13, 14, 15 years old. My uncles all left home before they were 14 and became cattlemen. It's perfectly possible for one boy to have gone up the trail with the first herds in, say, the mid-60s, right after the Civil War, and the last herds in the mid-80s or a little bit later. So it was all over in a very brief period of time. And the fact that it lasted such a short while lent a certain romance and a certain poignancy to it.
So you grew up on a cattle ranch?
Yeah, on a small ranch in central, north central Texas, just below the Red River, near a town called Wichita Falls, about 100 miles west of Dallas, Fort Worth, northwest.
Did your father expect you to keep on the ranch? And
I think he might have liked it. It was evident pretty early that this was not going to be my skill. It was also, my father was, not dumb, and he saw that the cattle business had already ceased to be a viable family business unless you own immense, immense amounts of land, which we didn't. And even my uncles, who left home early and got to the Panhandle when it was open range and ended up with very substantial amounts of land, couldn't survive as ranchers. Ranching is an industry almost entirely supported by oil or by other money. You know, the ranchers now are doctors and lawyers and architects and people who have gotten rich in other professions. It's my father foresaw this as early as I can remember, which is by the mid-40s. He saw that the amount of land that we had he made a decent living throughout his life. He was very, very skilled, but he was still in debt for 55 years. And he had four children. There's no way that if you divide that ranch by four that it can make a living for anybody. It wouldn't make a living for anybody even if it wasn't divided by four. And that was foreseen by my father very early on.
What was the life that you imagined you wanted when you were growing up in Texas, realizing that you wanted to get off the cattle ranch and you wanted to get out of the small town?
Well, I wanted a life in literature, essentially, and I realized that quite young. I didn't imagine that I would become a writer, but I knew that I could become a reader. And so reading has always drawn me from the age of five or six. It drew me out of the small town. It drew me to Houston, to Rice University. And it was sort of the strongest motivating factor for most of my youth. And as it turned out, like many readers, I began to try it for myself to see if I could do this thing that had given me so much pleasure. And I was lucky and successful. But it was reading that that took me off the range.
Were there bookstores around when you were growing up?
No, I had almost no books until I got to Rice. I did have a cousin who, as he was going off to war in 1941, I was like five at the time, stopped by the ranch house on his way to what turned out to be the Pacific Theater and left me some books, 19 books, in fact, just a bunch of sort of the normal boys' books of the time. And that was my library for quite a spell. There were some books in the high school library in Archer City, but not a whole lot. And I didn't really have adequate literary resources until I was a college student. Perhaps that's one reason I'm a rare bookseller as well as an author.
When you started writing books about the Old West, was your idea to further the myth, to debunk the myth of the West, or revise the myths of the West?
I didn't start really writing books about the Old West. I think Lonesome Dove was my 10th novel. Most of my books were set in the contemporary West and still are. And in fact, in my fiction, I think I've written 19 novels and one with my collaborator, Diana Osana. And of those 19, only about four of them deal with the Old West. Mostly I've dealt with contemporary Western life, a la Terms of Endearment, a la The Last Picture Show, or the book called Horseman Passed By that became the movie HUD. I thought that the Western myth, or the myth of the cowboy, is very powerful. I thought that Lonesome Dove was, in a way, a critique of it, because I grew up with cowboys. I respect them up to a point, but I'm not crazy about them, and I know, I think, something of their limitations, having grown up with them. So I didn't set out to write a book which glorified the myth of the West. I didn't particularly set out to write a book that debunked it either. I was telling a story of three men who had been friends for a long time, who got caught up in an adventure, and the book was a description of that adventure and its consequences.
Give us an example of something in the story that you see as a critique of the myth of the West.
Well, for example, the scathing denunciation that Clara Allen makes of Captain Call when he arrives at her house with Gus's body, when she tells him why she didn't marry Gus, although he was her great love, because she didn't feel that she could hold Gus, that she didn't feel that there was any room for a woman in a domestic relationship in Gus and Call's life. It's not that she felt that they hated women, it's just that they simply didn't give them their due. I think that women had a terrible time in the early West. Many of them went berserk. And I think that it was a masculine culture, maybe of necessity, but it was a masculine culture and to some extent crude, to some extent fascistic, certainly not welcoming to women.
Well, one of the main characters in your series, Lorena, is, she's a prostitute during some
she's
of the
a, Yeah, she's a prostitute and she's a whore in Lonesome Dove. And
she's kind of forced into it, really. I mean,
well, there's a character, strangely enough, in Dead Man's Walk, the book that's being filmed now, when they're debating, two men are talking about a woman named Matilda Jane Roberts, who was a whore. And one of the characters remarks on her origin. She came into the West when she was 14, and both her parents died trying to get from St. Louis to Santa Fe or somewhere along the trail. And she became a whore to survive. And one of the characters says there wasn't no room for church-going women in the West in those days, just room for whores, and a lot of them didn't survive. And that's true enough. You know, my grandmother was a pioneer woman, and the West was sort of unsettleable until after around 1875, simply because the Indian Wars were still raging intensely, and my own grandparents paused in their Western migration at a safe line in Northwest Texas. And lived there for 10 years. They didn't go any farther west because they wouldn't have survived the Comanches, very likely, if they had. And when the Comanches were finally subdued, more or less, in 1874, when their horse herd was destroyed, my grandparents went on to the place where they raised their family and where, in fact, I have the ranch house now, about 100 miles farther west into the Comancheria after it became safe.
Did your grandmother give you insights about what it was like to be a woman in the early days of Western settlements?
My grandmother, I don't remember my grandmother ever even speaking to me, although I lived with her. She lived in our house until she died, and I was a boy of 10 when she died. She had raised 12 children, lost one on a frontier. She was completely tired of children. She probably had 100 grandchildren by then, or between 50 and 100. She was used it up. I don't recall a single thing that my grandmother ever said to me.
Were you hurt? Sure.
No, I wasn't. I mean, it's only in the last few years that I've been looking back on that. Both my grandparents, and I mean, all four of my grandparents lived and died in the house that I was growing up in, and I had some relations with one grandfather. One of my grandmothers was substantially broken by the time I came into this world. And the other one wasn't broken, but she just sort of was through with children. I wasn't hurt at the time. I only reflect on it on that in the last few years that I really can't remember my McMurtry grandmother ever speaking a word to me. She must have, but I think it was more like get out of the way or shut the door or something like that. Certainly no stories ever came from her.
Larry McMurtry speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. He wrote the novels Lonesome Dove, The Last Picture Show, and Terms of Endearment, and many other books. He died last week at the age of 85. We'll hear more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with writer Larry McMurtry. His novel, The Last Picture Show, was adapted into a film in 1971, directed by Peter Bogdanovich. It stars Jeff Bridges, Timothy Bottoms, and Sybil Shepherd in a coming-of-age story set in a small Texas town. Let's hear a scene. Actor Ben Johnson won an Academy Award for his performance in the film as Sam the Lion, the owner of the town cafe, movie theater, and pool hall. Here he is with a couple of boys at the local fishing hole.
I never liked to clean fish or eat them either. Spend half your time picking out bones. Yeah, I just come out here to get a little scenery. Too pretty a day to spend in town. You wouldn't believe how this country's changed. First time I seen it, there wasn't a mesquite tree on it. Or a prickly pear, neither. I used to own this land, you know. First time I watered a horse at this tank was more than 40 years ago. I reckon the reason why I always drag you out here is probably I'm just as sentimental as the next fella when it comes to old times. Old times. I brought a young lady swimming out here once, more than 20 years ago. It was after my wife had lost her mind and my boys was dead. Me and this young lady was pretty wild, I guess. In pretty deep. We used to come out here horseback and go swimming without no bathing suits. One day she wanted to swim the horses across this tank. Kind of a crazy thing to do, but we'd done it anyway. She bet me a silver dollar she could beat me across. She did. The old horse I was riding didn't want to take the water. But she was always looking for something to do like that. Something wild. I bet she still got that silver dollar.
Whatever happened to her?
Oh, she growed up. She was just a girl then, really.
Did the place in Texas that you grew up in resemble the small town that you wrote about in The Last Picture Show?
Well, it was. That's where The Last Picture Show was filmed. I have the unusual circumstance of having seen one of my stories filmed in the place where it would have happened. The Last Picture Show and Texasville were both filmed in the small town of Archer City, Texas, which is where I grew up. The town is now sort of slightly confused. It's been so much fiction touched on it, but doesn't really know whether it's fact or fiction. And sometimes when I go home, I feel like I'm living in my own theme park. You know, they have restaurants called Texasville, and it's rather odd. I've inundated that little town with fiction, and, you know, most people think that they must be some character in one of the books. They're not quite sure which, and yeah, it's unusual.
That's funny because I think the reaction to The Last Picture Show was pretty bad when it was first published, the reaction in your town because of the sexuality in the book.
That's a little overblown,
is
actually.
It?
That's because journalists have to have something to write about, and the Baptist minister indeed was offended by the movie and one or two other people in town, but in fact a lot of people in the town worked on the movie. Saw what was happening. A lot of and you know, even then in 1971, it brought $3 or $4 million into the town. In a time like that, that county, which I suppose was cattle country when my grandparents stopped there in 1880, was definitely the oil patch by then, and it depends upon the fluctuation of fluctuations in oil prices, not cattle prices, and the cattle prices haven't amounted to anything for hardly in my lifetime, and I'm 60 years old. It's the oil patch, and when the oil business is up, it flourishes a little bit. But I've been buying building after building and putting, you know, books in them. The townspeople, I think, are slightly alarmed, but in fact, nobody but me wants those buildings. And you know, the town is down to a hardware store and a drugstore. Hmm. Doesn't have a hospital anymore, and it has a couple of filling stations, a hardware store, and a drugstore. you know, an abstract company and a bank, and that's about it. And if there's any other services in Archer City, it's their oil-related services, not cattle.
You know, I was thinking maybe we'd end the interview with a song by your son James, who's a singer-songwriter. Do you see his songs connected to your writing in any way?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think James is remarkable in that he's found a way to work that's not my way. That is, he's not a novelist. He's really more of a musician. But I think that the songs reflect a later stage of the same phenomenon. You know, the post, certainly the post-rural West, even the post-small town West, in a way. I think a lot of them are very good songs.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a very good talk.
Larry McMurtry speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1995. He died last week at the age of 85. Let's finish with a song by his son, James McMurtry. This is Leveland, which was one of Larry McMurtry's favorites. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Flatter than a tabletop. Makes you wonder why they stopped here. Wagon must have lost a wheel, or they lacked ambition one. In the great migration west, separated from the rest. Though they might have tried their best, they never caught the sun. So they sunk some roots down in this dirt to keep from blowing off the earth. They built a town right here, and when the dust had all but cleared, they called it Leveland.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Total Wine & More, whose guides can help find a Sunday brunch Prosecco or a rosé for roast lamb, with more than 13,000 wines, spirits, and beers to discover. More at totalwine.com. And from Indeed, with Instant Match, a hiring tool instantly delivering to businesses a list of candidates whose resumes on Indeed match the job description. Learn more at indeed.com/credit.
This is Fresh Air. Actor Christopher Maloney spent 12 seasons playing Detective Elliot Stabler on the TV series Law & Order Special Victims Unit before leaving the show in 2011. But he's back. Last night, NBC premiered the latest series of the franchise, Law & Order Organized Crime. The first episode was a crossover event with Law & Order SVU, in which Maloney teamed up with his old partner, Mariska Hargitay, as Detective Olivia Benson, who's now a captain. We thought we'd commemorate the reunion by listening to some of my 2019 interview with Maloney. Maloney's also known for playing a sociopathic inmate in the prison drama Oz, for his work on the series Homicide, and for his starring role in the sci-fi series Happy. Well, I wanted to talk about Law & Order, which is probably the role you're, I assume, best known for. You spent, 12 seasons there. And you worked as Detective Elliot Stabler working on special victims' crimes with Mariska Hargitay, she played your partner. Were you guys together the whole time you were there?
Yeah. We screen tested together. We tested for the role together. There were six actors. So you didn't know each other beforehand, huh?
No, no.
And why do you think you got the part?
Oh, boy, you know, all the actors who screen tested were great, but... And this is one of the rare moments when I walked in with Mariska. First of all, we were walking down the hall, and I was telling her a joke, telling her a story that was a funny story. And we walked into the room with all the suits and, you know, all the decision makers. And I said, hold on, guys, let me just finish this story. And from that, and the chutzpah, I thought right. about it afterwards. But that was the idea of you guys will hold on because we got control of the room. We're in here, and we got control of everything. We're going to control this scene and our characters. And it was pretty obvious. Even though I hadn't seen what the others had done, I walked out of that room going, wow, that was it.
Well, I wanted to play a clip here. In this scene, you are, as Detective Stabler, interrogating a child rapist who's been eluding you for years. He's played by Matthew Modine. And the scene begins with you, as Detective Stabler, leaning right into the suspect's face.
I don't need a PhD to know what kind of person you are. You're a loser. But you had a tough childhood that makes you special, that makes you a victim. You're nothing. You contribute nothing. The reason your life sucks is because you've done nothing.
I've done nothing.
You're counting the little children that you've raped and murdered? Is that what you're saying to me? You want to walk me through that, you piece of garbage? Tell me how good you are at torturing children. Tell me how strong you've got to be to kill a little girl. Huh?
That's our guest, Christopher Maloney, in Law & Order SVU, in a scene with Matthew Modine. A lot of intense stuff in this series. And you know, it's known that people that do this kind of investigative work, you know, who track predators who prey on defenseless people and commit the most awful of acts. It's psychologically damaging. It's hard to sustain. You did this for 12 years. You weren't, you know, it wasn't real. But, I don't know, did it take a toll on you? Did it affect your mood?
Yeah, first of all, let me just say, the real SVU detectives, because we toured their facilities and we got to speak with them. Boy, they're really heroic, and they would tell us a few stories you can't believe it. There are moments of true horror out there that these civil servants try to take care of. Boy, they're the heroes. So, having said that, we took our role seriously. You know, it became less of a job and more of a crusade or a something larger than ourselves, I'll say that.
Right.
And, you know, you're doing these scripts back to back, and it would take eight days to do an episode. So, you know, you start on Monday, and the following Wednesday you finish, and Thursday you have your new script. And this continues for 9 months. And after about 4 or 5 months, you're more liquid than solid. It just, you know, the horrors just keep coming and coming. And invariably, you know, it was the women, our women writers, who would write the toughest scripts. They pulled no punches. And I think the guys would feel intimidated or something, but the
restrained,
women.
Restrained, yeah.
Yeah, restrained, that's a better word. The women would just lean into it. So anytime I would see a female writer had written the script on the front page, I'd take a deep breath and go, oh boy, here we go.
You left the show after 12 seasons. What was it like? I mean, it just had become a part of your life for so long to not have that.
What it was like, and I knew it, I was actually very proud of myself. I always thought, when I do this, I'm going to feel like the house cat that got locked out of the house. You know, so this pampered animal. You work your whole career for what I got. You know, I hit the jackpot. I hit a show that meant something, was well written, was well received. You loved the working conditions and the people. It was a well-run machine. Every aspect was there. And yet, you know, the fill in the blank, the artist in me, the restless actor or creator, that guy needed to move on. So in the interim, I just worked on other projects and I got my pilot's license because I figured I really needed to truly focus on something that was, without question, a life or death endeavor.
This is something I didn't know. You fly airplanes.
Yeah, yeah. I got typewritten to fly a jet.
But so this was something that you kind of felt you needed to do? I don't know. The thrill, the danger of it, or what?
I started SVU as a, sometimes very employed actor, but always, you know, a journeyman type actor. And all of a sudden I had a home, and I had a lucrative home, and I had a satisfying home, and I built a family. I built a whole life. And I knew if I was walking away from all that, I needed to place that focus. Because, you know, if you're an actor, unemployed is not a good thing, especially when he's been employed. So, and I knew that about myself. I needed to employ myself in something that required every fiber of my being to stay focused and on top of things. And it was also good for my brain. I mean, I often said that I haven't studied that hard since college.
Wow.
Getting all of my ratings.
Actor Christopher Maloney recorded in 2019. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting French Exit, a new film from Azazel Jacobs, starring Michelle Pfeiffer as a widowed socialite who travels to Paris with her son and her cat once her money is gone, now playing. And from the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, providing scholarships to exceptionally high-achieving students with financial need from middle school to college. More information about Cook Scholarships is at jkcf.org.
This is Fresh Air. We're listening to some of the interview I recorded in 2019 with actor Christopher Maloney, best known for his 12 seasons as Detective Elliot Stabler on Law & Order SVU. Maloney is returning to the franchise. He stars in the new series Law & Order Organized Crime, which premiered this week. Let's talk a little bit about your background. You grew up in D.C., Washington, D.C., right? Middle-class family. Went to school in Colorado. Studied drama, is that right?
I studied drama, but I walked out of there with a B.A. in history.
Right. And how did you get into serious acting?
Serious acting?
Well, I mean, the kind of thing where you're not doing it for fun, like maybe I can make a living here. Maybe this can be my thing.
I took some acting classes as a lark, you know, in college, and I liked it. And I actually thought to myself, my God, I'm pretty good at this. But even more importantly to me, I realized how little I knew and that there was something to learn. There was an art here, and I was very curious about it. My father was a doctor, and I just didn't think that I could ask him to pay for my college tuition so I could take costuming and makeup and all that. I just didn't think he'd appreciate that. So I didn't major in it. I took as many classes as I could, and that was that. I graduated. That was it. I went home, promptly went back to a construction site because that's the only job, basically the only job I'd ever had through high school and college. You know, every summer I'd try and get a construction job. Yeah, but this time I didn't have college to rescue me, so I was a little bit depressed. I was calling around to figure out what guys were doing, what my old classmates from high school were doing with their lives. And I called up a high school buddy, and I said, what are you doing? What are you doing with your life? And he said, I'm going up to New York to study acting. And I thought, oh, my God, well, if you can do that, so can I. I asked them for the number. I called up the neighborhood playhouse, and I flew up the next day and interviewed with them.
Yeah, that's a serious acting school, right?
Yeah, yeah. And in the interview, it was for the summer program, the summer school program. In the interview, I'll never forget this, the guy told me to calm. He said, you've just relax. You've got to calm down. I was so desperate. I think of Richard Gere in An Officer and a Gentleman,
right?
Where he tells Lou Gossett Jr., I've got nowhere else to go.
Right, right. I remember that
desperate moment of his.
Right, right.
I'll never forget. I go, oh my God, I'm living the Richard Gere Officer and a Gentleman life right now.
So you got in, but I mean, you didn't immediately start getting big paid roles, right? I mean, you had to support yourself in New York.
Yeah. Yeah, I was a bouncer and a bartender and a trainer, and you know, I was sleeping on people's couches, and I was America's favorite guest for the first six months.
So you're working as a bouncer and other jobs, and you're working on your craft in the classes, and then you're going to auditions, right? You want to work. What did you learn about how to audition?
What an absolutely separate art it was from actual acting. Hmm. And at the end of the day, it was more of a Zen practice and a psychological, you defined psychological tricks for yourself to trick yourself into confidence and to almost manipulate the room. And if you're trying to please them, it's just like any relationship. You're toast. You have to who am I vis-a-vis this character? And this is it. And once you do that, once you're able to do that, all of a sudden you go into auditions feeling more empowered, and you walk out being far more satisfied and empowered.
The one other thing I have to ask you about, you were the quarterback of your high school football team, and you went undefeated. Is this true?
That is true.
You know, for most guys, like, their lives would be all downhill after that. Didn't define you, huh?
It actually did define me. Oh. And I, leading into my senior year, I had been on defense. I'd played on defense. I'd been a starter on defense. And, you know, but I was the backup quarterback on my sophomore and junior year. So senior year, this is now my turn, my shot. And I set three goals for myself. One was obvious. I'm going to be the quarterback. Number two, I wanted to be captain, and I wanted to go undefeated. And I willed that. I prayed for that. It happened. And I walked away. That defined me. And how it defined me was I felt that If I put my mind to something, I could bend the spoon. I could do anything I wanted to. I used that moment, and it's stayed with me. I still carry it, and I treasure that moment as one of the top five things that ever happened to me.
Well, Christopher Maloney, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
The pleasure was all mine. Thank you.
I spoke to actor Christopher Maloney in 2019. Maloney returned to the Law & Order franchise this week, starring in the new series Law & Order Organized Crime. Coming up, we hear some of Terry's 1980 interview with Watergate conspirator G. Gordon Liddy, who died this week. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. G. Gordon Liddy, the former FBI agent who planned the Watergate burglary that led to President Richard Nixon's downfall, died Tuesday at his daughter's home in Virginia. He was 90. Known for his dark, bushy mustache and fierce loyalty to the president, Liddy was among the most colorful of the Watergate figures. Working for Nixon and his reelection campaign, Liddy developed many bizarre plots to neutralize Nixon's adversaries, including kidnappings, sting operations using prostitutes, even the proposed assassination of newspaper columnist Jack Anderson. Most were never acted upon. Liddy never pleaded guilty to his Watergate crimes or testified to Congress about his activities, as many others did. Convicted of burglary and conspiracy, he served more than 4 years in prison before his sentence was commuted by President Jimmy Carter. After Watergate, Liddy wrote books, gave college speeches, dabbled in acting, and had a long-running syndicated radio talk show. Terry Gross interviewed Gordon Liddy in 1980 when Fresh Air was a local radio program in Philadelphia. Liddy was touring to promote his memoir called Will.
When do you believe that a person is above the law? Is a person ever above the law?
No, a person is never above the law so long as one understands what the law is and certain maxims about the law. First of all, I believe that what Cicero said is correct. The good of the people is the chief law. The question logically next to him is, well, who's to say what's the good of the people? You know, you, Gordon Liddy? Well, certainly not. The person who is chargeable with that responsibility is the president, because he's the one who's elected by the people. And if you disagree with him, well, then you elect somebody else the next time around. That's the way it works. That's why when I would have certain suggestions, they would be nothing but suggestions and would never be acted upon unless they were approved by my superiors in the White House, because I was not at that high a level where I could arrogate to myself very serious decisions such as those I was involved with.
So if a president says, yes, I think it's a good idea to bug Democratic National Committee headquarters, or yes, I think it's a good idea to assassinate a person, then in that case it becomes as if it was legal because you've gotten the corroboration.
Well, no, we've got to distinguish here, because you're getting into a legal area and a technical area, and I think it's important for us to distinguish. I was engaged in two different kinds of work when I was at the White House. One was, in my judgment, legal, involved national security and not politics, and that was the activities of the Odessa Group when we were, for example, trying to determine whether Daniel Ellsberg was a romantic loner of the left or whether he was an agent of the KGB. Now, that, in my judgment at that time, and the state of the law at the time, was clearly legal. On the other hand, when I was no longer with the Odessa Group and we were engaging in a political campaign and seeking political intelligence, clearly what was done was illegal, but not wrong, morally wrong.
What do you think you could have gotten if the Watergate break-in had worked?
Well, people misunderstood, I think, the purpose of it. They said, gee whiz, Larry O'Brien wasn't there half the time. You know, what's the point? Also, they said, you know, McGovern was the candidate and McGovern wasn't going anywhere. What's the point? Well, first of all, when all these plans were laid, nobody knew who the candidate was going to be. And indeed, the prime candidate at the time was Muskie, who was considered to be a potentially formidable candidate. And there was always in the back of the mind of those high in the Nixon White House that at any time Teddy Kennedy said, I want it, he could get it. And he was considered someone who would have been potentially a very formidable opponent. But when we went in there to put in, one, a room transmitter, and a telephone transmitter, the idea was not so much just to get what O'Brien might say in there when he was in there, but we knew that whoever the Democratic candidate would end up being from their convention, he would undoubtedly come back, and instead of his little headquarters that he'd been operating out of as a potential candidate, he would move into the DNC headquarters, his vast system of offices, and with our stuff already in place, we'd be able to read them from the word go. And also bear in mind that once a person is the candidate, they'd be surrounded by the Secret Service. It'd be a lot harder to get in there and do the job. So it made very good sense for us to do what we did when we did it.
I'd like to get back to the separation that you made between what's legally and what's morally wrong and what's legally and morally okay. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you were considering doing when you were trying to monitor Daniel Ellsberg was to put LSD in his soup before a speech that he had to give.
Right. That had been approved from above as a technique to disorient him, right?
Now, where does that fit into in the spectrum of
legality
and morality?
Yeah, no problem with that either, because had Ellsberg been a political opponent, I would say that would have been wrong. Ellsberg was not a political opponent. Ellsberg was someone who was stealing and had stolen highly classified information. And when one does that, when one puts oneself in the posture of an enemy or an antagonist of the state, one really ought not to be surprised when the state strikes back. It's the same situation as the thing we had in the 60s. When you riot and burn and things of that sort, you ought not to be surprised when the National Guard is called out and you get yourself shot. You're asking for it. And I don't have any problems with that at all.
When you, G. Gordon Liddy, put acid in someone's soup, or when you consider attempting to assassinate someone, that is different than a person who has had a fair trial, which is the demands in this country. It's something we cherish. In one case, you're taking the law in your hands, and you are being the arbiter of what's right and what's wrong and what's legally correct and what's morally correct.
The difference
in another, it's an organized system with checks and balances in it, and either a jury or a judge. Is that correct for you?
No.
If I were
a gas station attendant, your argument would make sense. But I was working for the President of the United States, and the difference is, as I think I may have mentioned, Cicero said, the chief law is the good of the people, and laws are inoperative in war. And when we look back on the 60s through the rose-colored glasses of nostalgia, we are inclined to conjure up visions of, young lady such as yourself in a long granny dress, maybe instead of wearing a horn-rimmed glass.
Begging your pardon, I never wore a long granny dress.
I say, such as yourself,
okay.
Not yourself. But in any event, and holding daisies in her hand, but what actually occurred was 125 cities went up. We had the National Guard and paratroopers called out to restore order, bombing of the capital of the United States. I mean, it just went on and on. That is, in my judgment, a state of civil war. And it certainly was permissible, as far as I'm concerned, for us to take what in other circumstances would have been extra-legal means in order to restore order.
Okay. I'd like to hear a little bit about some of the things that you did to strengthen your will, which you describe in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. For strengthening my will, primarily I used fire because I had a twofold effect. When I was a little child, I happened by accident, because I didn't know what it was, to pick up a hot coal, and it burned me and it scared me, and I was afraid of pain and I was afraid of fire for that reason. And at first what I wanted to do was get rid of the fear of pain and fire, and so I used fire and pain to overcome that, and then I simply used that as the same technique one would use when trying to strengthen physically an arm to increase the weights that one would lift. I increased the amount and duration of the fire until I reached the point of diminishing returns, which is where serious injury would set in, and that seemed to me to be unreasonable, and so I didn't do it.
You also tell a story about how you overcame your fear of rats. Could you tell us that?
Yeah. First thing I did, this again when I was a child, I would go down underneath the piers on the waterfront and try to confront the rats, and this didn't work very well because, first of all, rats swim very well, and they would just jump off and swim away. And I remained fearful of them, less and less, to be sure, but still I had residual dread. And finally, when my sister's cat killed one freshly, I recalled the fact that certain American Indian tribes used to consume the heart of an enemy that they considered to be courageous to overcome the fear of that tribe. And so I cooked and consumed part of the rat. And thereafter, I had no fear of rats.
So that worked.
Oh, yeah.
Gordon Liddy, how do you measure yourself to other people in history? Is there someone who you compare yourself to?
No, I don't think I would rate status as an historical figure.
Do you feel at some point Americans will appreciate what you did when you were with the White House?
I don't know that I'm all that significant. I think that at some point, Americans will realize that, Watergate was a tempest in a teapot, and the judgment of history on the Nixon administration, and Richard Nixon in particular, will be very close to what it is now in Europe, Asia, and Africa, and that is that he was a very competent president.
Watergate conspirator G. Gordon Liddy speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1980. Liddy died Tuesday at the age of 90. On Monday's show, Terry talks with Brandi Carlile. She won 3 Grammys in 2019, including Best Americana Album. Her new memoir opens with her as a very sick child, in a coma and near death. The book ends with Carlile, her wife, and their 2 children living in a compound with their extended family in the state of Washington. I hope you can join us.
Hang on, just hang on for a minute. I've got something to say. I'm not asking you to move on or forget it, but these are better days. To be wrong all along and admit it is not amazing grace.
But Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support by Joyce Lieberman, Julian Hertzfeld, and Al Banks. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Did I go on a tangent? Did I let it through my teeth? Did I cause you to stumble on your feet? Did I bring shame on my family? Did it show when I was weak? Whatever you see, that wasn't me. That wasn't me. Oh, that wasn't me.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, so shoppers can evaluate options in one place when buying home insurance. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com. And from Waystar, offering healthcare payment technology designed to streamline the revenue cycle and improve the financial experience for patients so healthcare providers can focus on what matters most. More at waystar.com.